Well, it's a great pleasure and privilege to be here with you tonight to look into this subject that has, I'm sure, been gripping you ever since you saw it announced. You have laid all things aside so that you could be sure to be here, because what else would anyone want to do in Lancaster County but study the canons of tort? So I am very appreciative that anyone showed up, and Robert insisted that I should begin by saying that it's a special privilege to be here with my favorite child. So it is a pleasure to be here, and I said to Robert driving over, is Zelten Reich Reformed Church the only church in Lancaster County that subscribes to the canons of Dort? And he said, yes, I think so. So we want to especially welcome you seekers who are looking for yet another Reformed confessional standard to subscribe, and I'm going to make the case as vigorously as I can. Seriously, I think this is a useful and important topic that we're going to look at together. Maybe not quite as important as the title that I chose some months ago. You know, titles are a funny thing, and sometimes by the time you get around to actually preparing the message, you think, what was I thinking? Saving the Reformation, that's kind of a dramatic title, isn't it? Maybe slightly melodramatic. But I think we can make a case together that the Synod of Dort and the Canons of Dort prepared by the Synod really were an important moment in the effort to maintain the great discoveries of the Reformation. Moving this year to the celebration of the 400th anniversary of the Synod of Dort from the 500th anniversary last year of the beginning of the Reformation, and Martin Luther nailing 95 theses to the church door in Wittenberg, is moving from a very famous event to a not so very famous event. It's moving from one of the great historical figures in all of history, and certainly all of church history, Martin Luther, to looking at a synod at which it's hard to think of anybody who was really famous who was there. You've all heard of the president of the synod, Johannes Bogerman. See what I mean? Maybe the most famous person there was actually the secretary of the president of the synod, William Ames, who was a distinguished Puritan theologian, English Puritan theologian. He was a refugee from England to the Netherlands, and like a number of the Puritan refugees to the Netherlands, were dismayed to see that their children were becoming Dutch, and preferred to move to the wilderness of New England rather than have their children turn out Dutch. So William Ames was going to leave the Netherlands to go and be the first professor at a little college being started in the wilderness of Massachusetts, ultimately called Harvard. And he died in Rotterdam waiting for a ship, and they sent his books ahead, which became the foundation of the Harvard Library. So there is a connection. You may think it's slightly labored, but there is a connection between Dort and America already in the 17th century. But I think what's important about Dort is the recognition there that a challenge was being made to some of the great discoveries of the Reformation. A challenge was being made to a Reformation church, a church that had been founded in suffering and in blood, a church that had been founded in the midst of a remarkable time in the history of the Netherlands, where it was not only a new church that was being founded, but a whole new nation was being founded. And those who had labored to see that new nation and that new church established, to see them both flourish and succeed, who felt they were already faithful were terribly distressed to discover that the state was being threatened and the church was being undermined by a new theology. A new theology that was being promoted by a pastor and theologian in the Netherlands by the name of James or Jacobus Arminius. Having lived a lot of my life amongst the Dutch Reformed, I know they can be very proud of their heritage. And so if you find yourself in the company of a Dutchman who's a little hard to keep under control, I recommend reminding him or her that the only really famous minister the Dutch Reformed Church has ever produced was Arminius. That'll settle them down and humble them just a little bit, I'm hoping. But when we think of Arminius, if we think about him at all, or the movement to which he gave his name, we realize we're talking about a movement that after his time became very influential, that had some significant influence in their own time in the Netherlands. But as I thought about it, I realized in some ways the importance of the Synod of Dort is related not just to facing Arminius and Arminianism, but to facing the reality that what Arminius represented was, we might say, the beginning of a whole new cultural turn in the West. Because what is increasingly emerging in the West is a more and more optimistic outlook on human nature. What is man? What are his abilities? What are his accomplishments? What is his goodness? This is a question that increasingly in the West, in the later 17th century, on into the 18th century with the Enlightenment, and even further later, will more and more want to assert that man is essentially good. Arminius didn't say that. You'd ask Arminius, he just said, oh, people are essentially fallen, essentially sinful. But he was an expression, I think, already of this broader movement that Reformation churches were going to have to face. What are we going to do with the challenge that increasingly says people are good? People may not really need grace. I saw a great interview recently with Oprah Winfrey. Now, Oprah Winfrey is a very talented, very fine person, does a lot of good things. But her basic outlook expresses the modern worldview in a disturbing way. She said, I have come to see that when people do something wrong, I shouldn't say, what's the matter with that person? I ought to say, what happened to him? And then I have to help him realize that all the power of solving his problem is to be found inside himself. And I thought, that's a powerful statement of exactly the opposite point of view from the Christian point of view. The Christian point of view says, the problem with me, now it's important, we know this stuff. It's important to say what happened to people. And there are people badly harmed by things that happened to them. We don't want to deny that for a moment. But as Christians, theologically, we want to say that the great human problem is what's in us, what comes out of us in our corrupted nature, and the great solution for us must come from the outside into us. And I think what happens with the rise of Arminius and Arminianism and many other factors in the 17th, 18th, 19th, 20th century is a cultural revolution that's saying people are good, not fallen. People have the resources they need to make progress. They don't need to find it outside themselves. And so the Synod of Dort, we could say, is sort of one of the first great battles against the tidal wave. That must be a mixed metaphor. One of the first great battles in the war that's going to break out between Christianity and anti-Christian optimistic forces of the modern age. And the reason I think it's worth spending time to talk about Dort is because the answer offered by the Synod of Dort is particularly biblical, is particularly pastoral, and is particularly theologically precise. Now, you don't always get those things all together. And indeed, one of the things we're going to see as we go along is that many, many people have failed to appreciate the power of the insights of the canons of Dort. We should pause there, I suppose. I've been talking about battles, and the canons of Dort are not the kind of canons that you fire in a battle. Canon is derived from the Greek word just for the rules of theology laid down by the Synod of Dort. These canons are really a wonderful spiritual as well as theological treasure for the church. And the reason that we don't always see that is because they were written in Latin. And even if you know Latin, an ability not so widespread anymore, even if you know Latin, it's very hard to render the long, 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 complicated Latin sentences into English that is genuinely readable. We really need a new translation of the canons of Dort. I'm working on that. We'll see how well I succeed. But that's really necessary because we, particularly early 21st century English readers, are not used to reading long, 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 complicated English sentences. We get lost. We give up. And in that process, we really lose something. So I'm going to try to convince you that the canons are really worth trying to study and trying to learn and trying to grasp because they really do contain some of the most mature, thoughtful, helpful, and pastoral reflections that the Reformed churches have ever done, and therefore really are a great, great resource that we ought to know better. Well, we're getting a little ahead of the game. Let's step back up for a minute and ask what had gone on in the Netherlands that the Reformation came there. The Netherlands, at the beginning of the 16th century, were really 17 loosely connected provinces, a little like the Confederacy of America. Before the American Revolution. That early confederation of colonies, each with its own character, each with its own history, each with a sense of its own identity, and only kind of loosely connected to one another. That's the way the Low Countries were. And by Low Countries, I mean what are today Belgium and the Netherlands. These countries all had passed under the authority of the Habsburg monarchy that ruled a great deal of Europe. And it was into that 17-fold states, if you will, that first came the preaching of the gospel. Now, the Netherlands was dominated by two languages, French in the south, Dutch in the north, and depending exactly your approach to languages, Fries in the far north. If you don't know about that, you can ask a question. So the initial preachers came up from the south. They came from Geneva, which was French-speaking. They came from the Reformed Church in France that was French-speaking. They came up into those southern regions of what is today Belgium, preaching the gospel in France and seeing a response. These were Reformed preachers. They were not the first Protestants in the Low Countries, the Netherlands. The first were actually Lutherans. The very first martyrs of the Reformation died in Brussels. Lutherans who had embraced the gospel and were executed for their faith. But Lutheranism never really became popular in the Netherlands. The first popular form of the Reformation in the Netherlands were the Anabaptists. Menno Simons, some of you may have heard of the Mennonites. Menno Simons was born in a small town way in the north of the Netherlands in Friesland. But there were other forms of Anabaptism in the 16th century. Today, if we are familiar with the word Anabaptist, we think of the Mennonites or the Amish, these gentle, pacifist, somewhat withdrawn from the world folk. But there was a whole other brand of Anabaptism in the 16th century, a violent form, a revolutionary form of Anabaptism. And those were the Anabaptists best known in the 16th century to everybody else. And so when you read your Belgic Confession and you come across the article that says, "We detest the Anabaptists," you think, "Oh, I don't know that I want to detest the Anabaptists. I have Anabaptist neighbors. They're lovely people." Those are not the people you're detesting. Because it goes on to say, "We detest the Anabaptists and other seditious persons." It's these violent revolutionaries that people reacted against. And that was a very widespread movement in the Netherlands, and it evoked a great deal of persecution from the Habsburg monarchy. Charles V, who had been stymied in Germany by Luther and the Lutheran princes, was not going to watch that happen in the Netherlands. And so the persecution became quite severe in the Netherlands. And then later, the Reformed began to move into the Netherlands. And that would ultimately become the most widespread, the largest, the most influential form of Protestantism in the Netherlands. Spreading rapidly through various parts of French-speaking Low Countries, and then more slowly into the Dutch-speaking parts there. Now, the persecution of the Protestants fed various kinds of unhappiness with the government and led to the outbreak in 1568 of a revolt against the Habsburgs and sparked what came to be known in history as the 80 Years' War. For 80 years, on and off, the Netherlands was torn by warfare as various parts of the Low Countries tried to throw off the Habsburgs and establish a measure of independence. And what ultimately happened is the country broke in two. And the southern part, which is today Belgium, remained under Habsburg control and remained Roman Catholic. And the north formed an independent country, in those days known as the United Provinces, today the Netherlands, and became a largely Protestant country. But it was a long and bitter struggle to accomplish that, a bitter civil war. And then the difficulty of figuring out, as the Northerners became independent, what do we do now? What kind of government do we have now? And of course, most of the people there only knew monarchies, only knew the rule of one ruler. And so they looked around to see if they could find a monarch that would take them on. That they really wanted Queen Elizabeth of England. Queen Elizabeth of England was a very smart cookie. She's not often described that way in history books, but she was a very smart cookie. And she thought, there's no chance these Dutchmen are going to beat the Habsburgs. So I'll give them a little money, I'll give them a little encouragement, but I'm not going to become their queen. Don't want to be queen of a bunch of losers. And so the Dutch found themselves in the north forced to become an independent republic. Nobody really wanted to be a republic, but since nobody would be king, they had to be a republic. And as the republic then is being formed, the Reformed Church is being formed. And the Reformed Church was being formed in ways that we're quite familiar with if we are Reformed or if we're Presbyterian: local churches, regional gatherings of churches, national churches. All of that was taking place amongst the Reformed in the Netherlands. Discipline, worship, a new way of trying to promote Christian living, all taking place in the Netherlands at the time. And doctrinal uniformity. These were Calvinists. Calvinists like to do everything decently and in order. Some people have accused us of thinking that's the only real Bible verse, that everything be done decently and in order. Well, we don't think it's the only verse, but it is a verse, and it's an important one. And so for the sake of order, the Dutch Reformed churches adopted the Belgic Confession as their confession. That confession had been written by one of the French-speaking preachers of early days, a very courageous man by the name of Guido de Bray. And Guido de Bray wrote this confession inspired by the French Confession of 1559 that probably Calvin had written or largely written. And Guido de Bray paid dearly for writing that confession. He was a martyr. As far as I know, that's the only major 16th century Protestant confession that was sealed with the blood of its author. So it was a very important confession to the Dutch, both for its own inherent teaching of the faith, but also because it had been sealed by the blood of a martyr. The Dutch early on also adopted the Heidelberg Catechism and took then from the Reformed Church in the Palatinate in Germany this catechism that soon established itself as a very attractive and popular catechism in a number of settings, not only in Germany, but also in Netherlands, and of course, for the sake of my wife, I have to mention also in Hungary. So this catechism proved to be a very popular way of teaching and understanding the faith. So here is this turmoil, we could say, going on. Civil war, the difficulty of establishing a new country, a new church, initially persecuted, now beginning to get government support, now beginning to put down roots, now beginning to be established, and only a few decades into its life arises this fellow by the name of Arminius. Arminius was born in the Netherlands in 1559. His early education was in the Netherlands. Then he was one of the very earliest students at the University of Leiden in the Netherlands, a new university founded by the Calvinists in Leiden. This university was commissioned by William of Orange, the great political leader of the Protestants in the Netherlands. And the story goes that in the Civil War, one of the crucial moments was when the Habsburg forces were besieging the city of Leiden. And William of Orange wrote and said, "You've got to hold out. You've got to hold out. The whole country will be split in half if Leiden falls." So Leiden went through great suffering, starvation of the citizens, but they held out until William of Orange could break the dikes and the sea waters began to rush in. And the Habsburg soldiers suddenly discovered that their army was being attacked by the Dutch navy. This is very disconcerting for an army, to find the sea waters rising around their knees and these shallow Dutch naval vessels floating in to attack them. So the siege of Leiden was lifted, and William of Orange, the story goes, came and said, "You people have been so noble that I will give you a great gift for your faithfulness in this war. And you can either be forever exempted from taxes, or you can have a university." And the people of Leiden were so noble, they chose the university. Now, if you've ever known a Dutchman, you know that story cannot be true. In any case, William of Orange did give them a university. And one of the very first students at that university was young Jacobus Arminius, very talented young man. His father died in the wars, and Calvinists supported him to get an education. He was so talented that they sent him off to graduate school in Geneva, and he studied there with Theodore Beza, Calvin's successor there, one of the great leaders of Calvinist orthodoxy at the time. He also studied briefly at Basel, another Reformed university. And then he returned to the Netherlands after those years of study to be ordained to the ministry in the Church of Amsterdam. Now, the Church of Amsterdam was one of the conservative Reformed churches in the country. And Arminius comes back from his study with a letter of recommendation, a glowing letter of recommendation from Theodore Beza, recommending him for ordination. And then Arminius, following the pattern of the time, was examined by the classis for ordination. Classis is roughly equivalent to a presbytery. Was examined for ordination and passes the ordination exams. We don't know for sure that Arminius subscribed the Belgic Confession, the Heidelberg Catechism, but everybody else in the Church of Amsterdam had to do that, so we assume he had to do that. And then for a number of years, he was a pastor there in the church in Amsterdam. Most of the time, apparently a relatively successful and non-controversial pastor, although he did a long series of sermons on the book of Romans. Now, you may be surprised to learn there are a few controversial passages in the book of Romans. And when he got to Romans chapter 7, there were some rumors about this guy and what he's preaching about Romans chapter 7. He disagreed with Calvin in the exegesis of Romans 7. He said that when Paul writes, who will deliver me from this body of death, the evil that I would not, that I do, and the good that I would, that I do not, Calvin said, that's the unregenerate man speaking. And Arminius said, no, I think it's the regenerate man. Well, you know, disagreeing with Calvin, not a good idea. So there was some to-do about that, but they worked it through. And then a couple of years later, he apparently preached very small passages from the book of Romans. A couple of years later, he got to Romans 9. And he got in trouble again for what he was saying about predestination in Romans 9. But again, they sort of covered it up, and he had a basically fairly successful pastorate for 15 years, from 1588 to 1603 there in Amsterdam. As a young minister, he did one thing that was really smart. He married well, married a rich girl, family influential, politically powerful. And after those 15 years, all of a sudden, there was an opening on the theological faculty at the University of Leiden. And plague had hit the town. Two of the three professors had died. And someone suggested Arminius to go and teach theology there. After all, he'd studied in Geneva. He'd had these glowing letters of recommendation. Everyone knew he was a very bright fellow, good communicator. But there were these questions, there were these concerns, there were these wonderings about Arminius. How sound was he? Well, the remaining theological professor at Leiden was a man by the name of Franciscus Gomarus, a thoroughly reliable fellow, orthodox as the day is long, longer. More orthodox than the day is long. And so finally the compromise was, well, we'll ask Gomarus to interview Arminius, and if Gomarus is satisfied, then Arminius can take up the job teaching at Leiden. So Gomarus interviewed him. And Gomarus came away from the interview saying, I'm entirely satisfied with what I heard. I would be glad to have him as a colleague. Now, this is interesting. What do we know about Arminius? We know that he went to Geneva and got a letter of recommendation from Beza. He went to Amsterdam, was examined for ordination, and was ordained. He goes to Leiden, is examined by Gomarus, and is found to be orthodox. So he becomes a professor in 1603. Must be reliable, right? In any case, he dies just 6 years later. How much trouble could he cause? This is one of the great, approaches to problem solving. Wait until they die. 6 years. Now, if you were living back then, what would you have done? You'd have said, let's read what he published and find out what he was thinking. Professors in those days, and even a lot of pastors in those days, had ready access to publishing houses that would publish their works. There was a great deal of theological stuff being published all the time. So let's go back and read what Arminius published. Are you ready? He published nothing. In his lifetime, he published nothing. And so the whole discussion that arose in the Dutch Reformed churches about Arminius was based on rumors and reports and what people had heard him say in a sermon or had heard him say in a lecture. It turns out he was writing, but he put all the writings in a drawer. They were not published till years after he died. This is funny business. That's a technical historical term. This is funny business that's going on. Finally, things had become so intense in debate about what he was saying or what he wasn't saying that the government got involved and in 1608 demanded that he write a treatise on what he really believed. That treatise still wasn't published until the year after he died, but at least the government and some of those at the center of this discussion were able to read what he had said, and they were alarmed. Because what he said was that in the whole history of the church, the kind of views being expressed by the strict Calvinists were dangerous in the extreme. And it had caused trouble in the churches, and it was completely unnecessary. This doctrine, he said, is so bad, it completely subverts the foundation of religion in general and of the Christian religion in particular. That's pretty strong stuff. But by a guy who's supposed to be a minister of this religion, a professor of this religion, a subscriber of this religion, a man who had letters of recommendation from people who subscribed this religion. What's going on? Well, you know, historians have scratched their heads ever since. And there are two broad schools of interpretation. The one school says, poor Arminius. Always picked on. Always persecuted by those Calvinists. All he could do was keep his mouth shut. What else could he do? Poor Arminius. Splendid guy. Splendid guy. But misunderstood, mistreated. The other school of interpretation says the Calvinists paid for his education. The Calvinists gave him letters of recommendation. The Calvinists made him a minister. The Calvinists made him a professor. And all they expected of him was that he believe what he said he believed. Abraham Kuyper's comment, who stood very much on this side, was, well, he was a crafty fox. It is a little hard to put together exactly what was going on. I have a theory that he was always somewhat troubled about predestination, and then somewhere in 1580s, early 1590s, he read a Jesuit book. Now, most of the Calvinists in the 16th century would have said, never read a Jesuit book. it can't do you any good. Well, whether that's always true, we don't know. But he read a book by a Spanish Jesuit by the name of Molina, who came up with a very sophisticated theology that is briefly called middle knowledge. And what middle knowledge says is, God knows all possible future events. And therefore, being able to see all possible future events and see how people with free will are going to exercise that free will in various future events, God can so set things up so that people will always make the decisions he wants them to make, even though they still have free will. There's a technical term for that. It's having your cake and eating it too. It's a clever move. There's been a kind of revival of Molinism in our time among certain Protestants who think this is a great solution. It is a great solution if you don't believe in total depravity. But we'll get back to that. So probably Arminius changed his mind somewhere along the line. But then he died, and that solved the problem. Well, ideas seldom die. And his followers picked up the torch, and the year after he died, they sent a petition to the government asking for toleration of their views and summarizing their views. They summarized their views in, are you ready? 5 points. Have you ever heard of 5 points? Now, the most important thing to take away from tonight is this. Calvinism does not have 5 points. Do you know that? Calvinism does not have 5 points. If you read the Belgic Confession, it has 37 points. If you read Westminster Confession, now see, I'm revealing my ignorance. I don't know exactly how many chapters the Westminster Confession has. 33. Thank you, sir. You see, Calvinism has always expressed itself in confessions that are comprehensive, that talk about all sorts of critical doctrines. If you want to know what Calvinism believes, read the Belgic Confession, read the Westminster Confession, read the Heidelberg Catechism, read the Westminster Larger Catechism. Shorter's all right, but, you know, that's for children. These are the full statements of what Calvinists have believed. No Calvinist ever summarized Calvinism in 5 points. Arminians summarized Arminianism in 5 points. And their 5 points were conditional election, elections on certain conditions, universal atonement, total depravity, sort of. We'll come back to that. Resistible grace, and perseverance of the saints, we're not so sure. Those were the 5 points of Arminianism. And to those 5 points of Arminianism, the Calvinists had 5 responses. So the 5 points of Calvinism are not Calvinists' summary of Calvinism. They're Calvinists' responses to the 5 points of Arminianism. And they are important because the Calvinists saw in the Arminianism a serious threat to the very foundations of Reformation theology. What's Reformation theology? How would you summarize it? Well, we've just been through a great year of thinking about the Reformation, and many times we've tried to summarize it, even though the Reformation itself didn't, tried to summarize it in solas, haven't we? Sola gratia, grace alone. Solus Christus, Christ alone. Sola fide, faith alone. Sola scriptura, scripture alone. What is the attack on election? It's really an attack on grace alone. What is the attack on the atonement? It's really an attack on Christ alone. What is the attack on irresistible grace and the perseverance of the saints? That's really an attack on faith alone. And so in a profound sense, these Calvinists, when they saw this Arminian summary, said, it's the Reformation that's under attack. It's interesting, when Gomara saw it, he said, this is an attack on justification. Now, the Arminians really hadn't talked much about justification at all, but Gomarus was right. They are redefining faith. They are redefining grace. They are redefining the work of Christ, and it's undermining what we, as children of the Reformation, have believed about grace and about Christ and about faith. Doherty is not about narrow, sectarian, Reformed issues. It's about the foundations of the faith. And that's why I think it really is worthwhile to spend some time thinking about what Dort accomplished. Now you may be thinking, yes, but you haven't gotten to Dort yet. And that's true. But I'm going to get there now. After almost a decade of serious wrangling in the Dutch Reformed Church, finally, in 1618, the government gave permission for a national synod to be held. The government had not wanted a national synod. You get a whole country full of Calvinists together, what kind of grief might come out of that? The government had resisted for 30 years having a national synod. And it really took a coup d'etat in the government to allow for the calling of the national synod. These are wild and woolly times. Finally, the synod is called, and the Arminians immediately call foul. You're just going to have a synod of Calvinists judging us. We don't stand a chance. It's a kangaroo court. And so the Calvinist leaders of the Dutch Reformed Church said, all right, we'll make it an international synod. We'll invite representatives from all the Reformed churches of Europe to be present, to have full voting participation in this synod. This is the only really, genuinely international synod the Reformed churches have ever had. And so they invited the various German Reformed churches from the various German provinces, about five or six of them, to come. And they invited German-speaking Swiss Reformed churches to come. Somebody forgot to send an invitation to the Genevans. Oh, it was terrible. The Genevans complained, and then they got invited. You know how this happens. It's like a wedding. You know, you always leave someone off the list. It's terrible. So the Germans are coming, the Swiss are coming, an invitation to the King of Great Britain, James I of England, James VI of Scotland. And James is very interested in this. James hated Presbyterians because he'd been raised by Presbyterian tutors, but he rather liked Calvinism. So he's all for supporting this synod, and he appoints a very distinguished delegation to go to the Netherlands. And then one of the Presbyterians in Scotland says, hey, you didn't appoint any Presbyterians, just Anglicans. And James reluctantly added one Scot to the delegation, who was a member of the Church of England. So all these little tidbits of feuding and fussing. Another issue that the poor Dutch had not anticipated was they also invited the Reformed Church of France, which at that time was a significant Reformed Church, 1.5 million members. And the Synod of the French Reformed Church appointed delegates. And then immediately the French and the English started fighting over who should have the best seats at the Synod. The British said, "We represent the greatest Protestant monarchy in Europe. We should have the best seats." And the French said, "We represent the greatest monarchy in Europe. We should have the best seats." And then the King of France said to the French Reformed delegates, "Well, I'll give you an exit visa, but not a re-entry visa." So the French delegates stayed home. The Dutch had an etiquette problem solved for them. And if you look carefully at the picture in your program, there on the right side, as we look at it in the back, you can see some empty seats. Those are the French seats, just below the English seats. So the English got their way because the French weren't there. So the synod meets in November of 1618. The next time you get sent to a classis meeting or a presbytery meeting or a synod meeting or a general assembly meeting, bear in mind the Synod of Dort met from November 1618 to May of 1619. And most of those delegates were there the whole time. So it was a long session. There were several dramatic moments. The Arminians were represented by a man by the name of Episcopius, who was asked to make an opening address, and he spoke for something over 2 hours. One of the observers said, "Finally, Episcopius got to the part for which we had all been eagerly waiting, the end." So that was a dramatic moment. And then president of the synod, Borgerman, got so tired of the Arminians wasting their time that he threw them out, dismissed them with a powdering speech, it was said. And that was a dramatic moment. And then there was the great moment when Gomarus, a bit of a hothead, was debating a German delegate by the name of Martinius from Bremen, and he didn't like what Martinius was saying, so Gomarus challenged him to a duel on the floor of the Senate. So, you know, church meetings can be exciting. the brethren interposed, and there was no duel, I'm glad to report. The Synod accomplished a number of things. It appointed a Bible translation committee that would ultimately translate the Bible into Dutch, into what in the early 17th century was modern Dutch, and provided Dutch-speaking people with the equivalent of the King James Version for English-speaking people. And we have a few old books here, a couple of them thanks to Bill Osterman. This one was my son's. This is an old Dutch Bible of the Statenvertaling, the translation commissioned by the Synod of Dort. And this is English annotations translated from the Dutch on that Bible. And you can also see a Dutch Psalter here if you want. If you want to improve your Dutch, this is an exhibit to help you out. So the Synod did a number of quite important things, talked about what the churches believed about the Sabbath, talked about what the churches believed about catechism. How do you get young people to study their catechism? Well, one suggestion was don't let them get married until they can recite their catechism. That would be a way of getting them to, and, you know, it might work. We could discuss that. So there are a number of things the Synod did, but the great work, of course, was preparing the answer to the Arminians. And I think what's important for us to remember in that regard is that they decided they really wanted to write a document that would help the lay people. And that's part of the tragedy of a bad translation of the canons. This was not intended for scholars. This was not intended for ministers. It was intended to help the lay people understand the truth. And so they wrote it in what they called popular language. And I think a good translation if we can ever get one, would help us see that. And they did it in a way to help people see not only what was theologically true, but to help people see how that truth is spiritually profitable. They didn't want people just to think right. They did want people to think right. But they wanted to see that sound theology leads to godliness. And that's what we want to try to do tomorrow, is to really look at this theological, but pastoral and biblical theology intended to help the people of God. This is the Arminian charge, that Calvinism leads the souls of men away from all piety and religion. And the canons of Dort were very much written to show that's just not true. In fact, Reformed theology leads the souls of men to piety and sound religion. So that's what we want to talk about tomorrow, the specifics of what the Synod of Dort accomplished with its canons. But I wanted to set this scene because I think it's so important to see how difficult the situation was that the Synod faced, and how remarkable the accomplishment was, because in the end of the day, the Synod voted unanimously to adopt the canons. Most of our church gatherings can't vote unanimously to adopt minutes. So this is a remarkable accomplishment. I think of the Holy Spirit leading people to a profound appreciation and defense of the truth. Well, I understand we have a little time for questions. I'm sure there aren't any, that I've answered absolutely everything you could have thought about. But Robert, are you going to come up, or somebody's going to? If you have a question, just raise your hand. I see ladies going to prepare refreshments downstairs, so we won't linger. But if there are questions, I'd be glad to try to answer them.
Yeah. What led you to suspect that Arminius was reading Molina?
They have a record of his library, a catalog, an inventory of his library when he died, and he has the second edition of Molina in that library, which was published in 1595, the first edition in 1588. We don't know for sure if he saw it, but we do know he did have that volume. So it's a pretty good chance that he read it. And of course, in fairness to Arminius, I don't often preface my statements that way, but in fairness to Arminius, it would have been very dangerous for him, had he learned anything from Molina, to admit it at that time. I mean, dangerous for his position as professor.
Hello, Pastor Godfrey, big fan. I want to put a good word for Lancaster County. If you're looking for a place to retire, this is...
This is my fan club. There are two people in it, and I'm glad at least 50% are here. You know, it's very encouraging.
I can get a lot of signatures.
Two questions. One question, how do you respond to those that say, I'm not a Calvinist and I'm not an Arminian either, those in church I'm talking about? And the second one, how do you respond to someone that can't accept Reformed theology because they say Reformers killed Anabaptists because they rebaptized Anabaptists? Thank you.
Yes. Well, those are great. Those are great questions. What was the first one?
What would you say to someone that says?
Oh yeah. Okay. Well, there's the smart aleck answer and there's the pastorally sensitive answer. And I'm afraid usually we Reformed people are better at the smart aleck answer than at the pastorally sensitive answer. The smart aleck answer is, if you say I'm neither a Calvinist nor an Arminian, you're an Arminian. And I actually think that's probably the case. The pastorally sensitive answer, of course, is to talk about why someone wouldn't want to identify themselves as Calvinist. It's interesting, of course, Calvin would be horrified to hear us talk about ourselves as Calvinists. Calvin wasn't interested in having Calvinists. He wanted people who were Reformed. And if we remember, that Reformed is really a shortened version of Reformed according to the Word of God. That's what Reformed really meant. We are those who are Reformed according to the Word of God. And so rather than trying to get people to identify with Calvin, what we want them to do is identify with the Word of God. And we want to say to them then, you know, where do you think Reformed Christianity doesn't get the Word of God right? Can we talk about that? Can we study that? That's what we ought to do, and that would be a better thing to do. Now, on Anabaptism, there are a lot of things in Reformed history that we don't have to try to defend as in any way right. But to try to be a little more detailed about that history, in the Code of Justinian, which was prepared in the 6th century AD, it was declared to be a capital offense to rebaptize somebody. That was already a problem in the ancient church. And that law was still on the books in the 16th century. And when Anabaptism spread to various parts of Europe, governments executed some Anabaptists for rebaptizing. And there were Calvinists who supported that. Calvinists did not execute anybody. They didn't have the authority to execute anybody as a church. It was done by the state, and it was done under an ancient law. I can't imagine any modern Calvinist thinking that was legitimate or supporting that, but there were Calvinists who supported it in the 16th century. And, you know, part of our response to that has to be, we're sinners, and our hope is to be saved by grace. Let's talk about grace together, and let's talk about sin together. And if you're going to separate yourself from all sinners, you're going to be even in a smaller group than the Godfrey Fan Club. And that's the beginning of where I think a conversation should take place. Yes.
What percentage of the evangelical church today would you say is Arminian?
That's a great question, and I'm not sure I have a great answer. Part of what we're facing today in the early 21st century is, what is an evangelical church? I mean, we're almost in as bad a shape, I think, as we were at the early 20th century when we had the split between modernists and fundamentalists over who was the real evangelical. And today there are people who call themselves evangelical whose theology is so broad that certainly 30 years ago we might not have called those people evangelical. But anyway, I would say in America, certainly the majority of evangelicals are Arminian. Calvinism has made a bit of a comeback. It's gotten, you know, young, restless, and reformed. We're suddenly slightly cool. You can be so out of it that you can actually become cool just by being so far out. And that may be partly true of us. I do think that for people who have become more interested in theology, Calvinism has made a big comeback in the last few decades, because a lot of Arminians in the 20th century kind of lost an interest in theology. It was all about evangelism. It was all about outreach. It was all about service, all good things. But those who then wanted to dig more into theology found that Arminianism didn't have a lot of theology in the later 20th century. Whereas if you go back to Arminius himself, he has a rather profound theology, just wrong in my judgment.
Would you pass the mic? How widespread were the ideas, I guess we'd call it semi-Pelagianism, that Arminius was adopting? Was he so much alone on this? Was he just joining others? And how did this spread so quickly? Was it through his students that within a few years this had become such a big issue?
Yeah, again, it's a little hard to know exactly how big it was. When Arminius died in 1609, he certainly had close friends and former students that had formed something of a fan club. We keep coming back to that theme. And when the remonstrance, the petition, was signed in 1609, there were 42 ministers that signed it, which is a fairly small percentage of the Dutch Reformed clergy as a whole, but there may well have been ministers who didn't sign it that had sympathy for it. So it's a small but not insignificant minority in the Dutch Reformed Church, I would say, by his day. Arminius himself and some of his apologists tried to argue he represented the old Reformed tradition in the Netherlands of Erasmus and others. Of course, Luther and Erasmus had fought over almost these exact same issues. And so there was some effort to make that kind of claim, but contemporary historians today are by and large unconvinced that there was this old Reformed tradition. It had always been a pretty solid Reformed tradition in the Netherlands. And so this is a kind of new thing that's coming up and is small but has significant government support. And in those days, throughout Europe, government and church were so intertwined, government support became very important. But it's a fairly small minority in the Dutch Reformed churches.
Convinced of not believing Calvinist doctrine on predestination and total depravity?
That's been the source of a lot of debate recently amongst historians. It's always amazing what historians can debate. In 72, there was a really, in many ways, good biography of Arminius published in English by Carl Bangs. And Carl Bangs argued vigorously that Arminius never changed his mind. If you argue that Arminius never changed his mind, then somehow Beza couldn't see it, the Classis couldn't see it, Gomarus couldn't see it. It's pretty hard to believe that, it seems to me. I think he changed his mind probably in the late 1580s or early 1590s, and realizing how controversial it would be, he kept it to himself. Yeah, you know, today you can buy three fairly thick volumes of Arminius's work. That was all written and kept in the drawer, and some of it is a pretty vicious attack on Gomarus. And the reason I think you can argue that he was not entirely honest, and I don't mean to say that you should dismiss his theology because he wasn't entirely honest, but in 1605, so just 4 years before he died, the government asked the three professors at Leiden whether they got along and shared a common faith. And the three of them said, yes, we do. And in the drawer of Arminius was a vicious attack on Gomarus that really implies that his theology wasn't Christian at all. So that seems a clear case where Arminius was not being fully straightforward.
Yeah, thanks. I had a quick question. In response to the adoption, unanimous adoption, was there an effect on Arminianism after that? Was it tamped down for a time?
The ministers who would not accept the decision of the synod were expelled from their office, and some of them were exiled out of the Netherlands. When they returned, they formed their own. It was called Remonstrant Brotherhood or Arminian Brotherhood, which was a small church. And so at least for a considerable amount of time, the Dutch Reformed churches did not have a recurrence of of Arminianism. Although it is interesting that just as it had been 30 years since the last National Synod until the meeting of the Synod of Dort, actually the Synod of Dordrecht, Dort is an abbreviation of the Dutch city Dordrecht. After the Synod of Dort adjourned, the government allowed no National Synod to meet for almost 200 years. So they really wanted to keep the church under control. Calvinists are dangerous. We don't see enough of that today, it seems to me. But anyway, Calvinists have been known to be dangerous. It's cookie time.